Warning, this episode contains violent content.
Okay. Hi, welcome to Sistery Untold. We are your sisters and hosts, Sabrina
and Marva.
And on this podcast, we look at history through the eyes of sisterhood.
That was like almost pretty good. I heard you like...
It's because... When I was going to say history, I was going to say sistery. And then after that, I was like, phew, I said history. But then I was like, I almost said sistery. And then I was like, sisterhood. And I was like, sisterhood? And so I was like thinking while I was saying it. Yeah. It was very strenuous mentally. Yeah.
I can tell.
Yeah.
I could see in the way your eyeballs were moving back and forth.
Oh, I can't see you. You turned off your camera.
I know, because I don't know if it's bad for our connection.
Okay.
I'll turn it on, and then if it's bad, I'll turn it off.
Okay. So.
Okay. Well, anyways, after that riveting...
I know, introduction. So, I'm guessing you have a sistery for us?
Yes, I do. I have a sistery that is about three lovely ladies from the Netherlands.
Three? This is a bonus.
Yeah, two sisters and a bonus gal.
Okay.
Yeah. So this episode is going to be going all the way back to World War II, which we've already talked a bit about World War II in two episodes in our previous season.
Yeah.
So I'm not really going to like get that deep into like what is World War II. But if you want to know, go back and listen to our episode about Hannah and Melita.
Yeah. I also think it's funny that you say this episode goes all the way back when you've done a bunch of, like, medieval episodes. And, like, this is, like, yeah. The most modern we do is, like, World War II.
Oh, that's true. Have we not done anything more modern?
We did, like, Thelma and Louise, but that was, like, a film one.
Okay,
Yeah, I don't think other than that we've done anything, like, more recent. I think, like, after, like... After World War II, it starts to feel, like, less historical. I do want to do an episode on Hannah Arendt and this other person. And, like, their lives, like, extend beyond World War II. But they're, like, their lives get started, like, kind of during that era. Like, their, like, professional lives, you know. But.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's fair. Well, anyways, we'll see that this comes very close to our current time period. Because their lives also happily extend past World War II as well.
Okay.
What is that called? When you give something away without like actually watching the show? Yeah, spoiler. That's a spoiler.
Okay. Plug your ears, everybody.
Okay. Anyways. So, but I will just do like a very super, super quick overview of World War II, which it started in 1939 when Germany invaded Poland. And there was two sides. There was the Axis powers, which were Germany, Italy, and Japan. And then there were the Allies, which were like the USA, the UK, or Great Britain, and other people.
The USSR.
Who... Oh, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Marva.
All the U's.
You're supposed to be an authority on this. Oh, dear. Okay.
All the U
countries. Or it might have been called the Soviet Union. I don't know if there's a difference, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, they were there doing their thing.
Yeah. On the Eastern Front.
Yes. And so, as we spoke about in our previous World War II episode, there were groups of people who were resisting Nazi rule, even within Germany itself. Like we talked about, there's at least, I think, 30 failed attempts to assassinate Hitler by people like within Germany. And then there was more plans that like didn't get acted on. So those are the, just the actual, like, we literally tried. And same goes for like the other Axis powers, like Mussolini and like people like that. What?
Mussolini and people like that.
You know, okay. The Mussolinis of the world.
Yes.
All of them. Then there were also like organized resistance movements that like all these countries had. So why am I sounding so vague about
I know.
Everything? I was trying to be brief, but I'm just like... Okay. Well, you know, the Mussolinis, they're being attempted to be assassinated.
Okay. Yeah, it's okay. When I talked about the English Civil War, I was like, there was a king, then there wasn't, then there was a king. Like, that was my summary of it, so it's okay.
Yeah. I'm like, this is all background, okay? Yeah, so resistance could be correlated basically by the level of influence that the Nazis had in an individual country that they invaded. So it's estimated that in Western Europe, about 1-3% of people engaged in organized resistance. And in Eastern Europe, where they often like had more Nazi rule, take up in resistance movements was much higher. Like in Poland, for example, it's more like 10-15% of people were part of organized resistance movements.
That's like 1 in 10 people, you know, like that's a lot.
Is it?
Yeah.
Or is it 1 in 100?
1 in 100 people that you know. Whatever. A lot.
No, you're right. It's 1 in 10, isn't it? Oh, gosh, more math after last episode.
No, 10% of 100. Wait, 10% of 10. Wait.
It's 10.
Okay, I don't know, man. Wait, what's 1? 1 is 10% of 10. So, yeah, it is 1 in 10.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
I'm still not convinced, but okay.
I'm pretty 70% certain that okay, 1 in 10 listeners. Equals 10%, just like how 10 in 100 equals 10%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it would be 10 people out of every 100 people, or 1 person out of every 10.
Yes. Okay. If you know 100 people, then you know 10 people. Okay.
Let's, everyone, please just skip forward 30 seconds.
Yeah, not a math podcast.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Poland, like I said, had the 10%, the 1 in 10, the 10 in 100. They were one of like the biggest resistance movements, along with the French and the Dutch and the Soviets and the Yugoslavs. Other European countries, of course, had movements too. There was like Italian resistance, Greek resistance, Belgian resistance, Norwegian, Danish, Czech, Albanian. Basically everywhere that the Germans invaded, there was some kind of resistance movement. Mm. I just didn't want to like leave somebody out.
I was like, I feel like you're just naming all the countries. Albanian ones. But then I realized that's what you were trying to do. And I was like, okay, she's trying to be like...
That is exactly what I'm trying to do.
Okay.
Trying to be fair. Yeah. But today we are going to focus particularly on the Dutch resistance. The Dutch remained neutral during World War I, and it looks like that was their intention for World War II. In fact, the Netherlands had not been at war with any European country since 1830. So they were trying to just be everyone's friend. Mm-hmm. Their proximity to Germany, though, meant that in November of 1938, during Kristallnacht, which, if you don't remember, listen to Hannah Melita, you could actually see German synagogues burning from places in the Netherlands.
Wow, that's so crazy.
Yeah. Despite this, it was still somewhat of a shock to the Dutch when, on May 10th, 1940, Germany invaded the Netherlands. There was no declaration of war, it was just a sneak attack. Like, the day before, small groups of German soldiers wearing Dutch uniforms snuck into the country, and, like, they didn't have enough uniforms, so some of them were actually just wearing, like, helmets made of cardboard. Hmm. But the Germans deployed 750,000 men, which was 3 times the strength of the Dutch army.
Oh my gosh.
Sent 1,100 planes, which the Dutch, like, Army Air Force had 125.
Oh my gosh.
And, yeah, and sent 6 armored trains. And in their invasion, they destroyed 80% of the Dutch military aircraft on the ground in one morning through bombing.
Whoa. They were just, like, coming in, like, there was no chance of defeat ever. Yeah.
Yeah, so they were not messing around.
Yeah. It's, like, way, like, so superfluous, though. Like, they could have gone in with, like, just, like, double what they have, you know? But they went in, like, with, like, 10 times more, you know? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
Yeah, well, I guess, like, you know, at this point, they've already, like, invaded Poland and other places, and so they know that people are probably going to resist, and you just got to come in, like, and show, like, all the force, and, like, don't even bother trying to resist, exactly. because, like, there's 100,000 million of us. Exactly, 100,000 million, no less, no more. So, this is the world that we're talking about when we talk about the sisters today. So first, we're going to meet Truce and Freddy Overstegen.
If it's German, it's Overstegen. But I don't know if what the Dutch pronunciation would be like.
I'm sure it's close enough.
Okay. Overstegen.
So, Truce was born on August 29th, 1923. She had a younger sister, Freddy, who was born on September 6th, 1925. They lived in a village called Schotten in the Netherlands, which was just outside Haarlem. When they were young, they lived on a barge, like a boat, with their mother and their father, but when their parents divorced, their father left, and the girls and their mother moved into a small apartment in town. Although their mother remarried and later had a son, the family lived in relative poverty for most of the girls' childhoods. Truce and Freddy had their differences. Truce was more of like a tomboy, she was assertive, and as older sisters do, she had a tendency for bossing her younger sister around.
Oh, don't I know it.
Don't I know it? I've got two older sisters.
I have three older sisters.
Freddy was more graceful and mischievous, and as a young teen, she was keen to assert her independence. The area the girls grew up in was called the Red Zaan region, which it was red for communist. Their mother was an active member of the International Red Aid Organization that was affiliated with the Communist Party. During their youth, the girls were exposed to their parents' brave acts of generosity. When they lived on the barge, the family would take in refugees and have them live on the boat with the family. And before the war, they took in German and Jewish refugees who made it across the border. Their parents instilled a strong sense of social responsibility and justice in them, and their dedication to social justice would be put to the ultimate test when World War II broke out and the Nazis invaded Netherlands in May of 1940. Truce was 16 and Freddy was 14.
So young.
Yeah. So, Sabrina, it's May. It's May 10th, 1940. You're 14-year-old Freddy. The German troops have just arrived and surprise attacked your country. The invading army is three times the size of your country's army, and they've destroyed 80% of your military aircraft. What do you do?
Oh, freak out. That's so stressful.
Okay,
what am I supposed to do? I'm 14.
Well, lucky for us, you are not Freddy, because... Freddie did not freak out. Well, maybe she did, but she at least kept that part.
I'm sure she freaked out a little bit.
She may have freaked out a bit, but then she overcame her freak out, and she and her family continued to help Jews escape from the Nazis and take Jewish families into their home to hide them. And at 14 and 16, the girls started handing out anti-Nazi pamphlets, along with distributing pamphlets. Freddy and Truce also glued warnings across German posters in the street, calling men to work in Germany.
The posters were, like, calling on Dutch men to work in Germany.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And then they would post a warning, like, glue warnings on top of them. Yeah. These actions were not just rebellious, but they were dangerous because the punishment for doing this could be death.
Dang.
Yes. So, this was work that the girls were doing on their own and with the support of their mother. Their actions did get them noticed, however, noticed by the Dutch resistance. A commander of the resistance paid a visit to their home to ask their mother if he could recruit the girls to join them, and their mother agreed. In the beginning, he didn't say outright, like, what their roles in the fight would be, but they would soon come to learn that they would not be taking on the typical roles of female resistance fighters. They would be sabotaging railway lines and bridges, and they would need to learn to shoot.
Okay. What were the normal roles for women, do you know?
More like being like messengers and doing like less frontline-y kind of stuff.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Some spying, you know. Mm-hmm. But before we get on to, like, what they did during the war, we're going to meet our other sister, Hanny Shaft. There's not that much information about any of these girls' like childhood, you know, because they're just like normal people. Like, I'm sure if we were to die, like, people would be like, oh, Marva went to school at Foothill Elementary and then she graduated.
Yeah.
And,
like, that. Yeah, that'd be like the extent of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
This is why everyone needs to write a memoir.
Yeah. I mean, but do you think about writing a memoir when you're 14? I don't know.
Yeah, but when you're older, I don't know.
Yeah.
You can be like, oh, look, I ended up being important. And then you can write a memoir.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, okay. We can discuss philosophically how do you decide whether you're important or not at another time.
Okay.
But, again, Hanny Shaft. So, when Freddie and Truce joined the Harlem Council of Resistance, they were the only two women in the group. And women, like, they were girls, they were 14 and 16.
I know, I was like, women, yeah. Children.
That did not last long, though, because they were soon joined by our other sister, Hanny. Hanny was actually born Jeanette Joanna Shaft, which is maybe how you would pronounce in English. You might pronounce it differently in Dutch, but I don't know. She was born on September 16th, 1920, which is 2 days before my birthday. So she's a Virgo. And she was born in Harlem. Growing up, she went by the nickname Jo or Joppy. Her parents were Afia Talia Shaft, which was her mother, and her father was Peter Shaft. Both of those are Dutch, if you can tell. So just think that in a Dutch accent. She also had an older sister whose name was Anna. Her father was a member of the Social Democratic Workers Party, and politics and social justice were something that was often discussed in the Shaft household. While Hanny's parents encouraged her to be actively involved in politics, they were also very protective of her. Hanny's older sister died in 1927 from diphtheria, and this made her parents be extra cautious with her.
So sad.
I know. Hanny was pretty shy as a child, and despite her beautiful and striking red hair, she was fairly withdrawn, probably due to her shyness and her parents' overprotective nature. What?
Why'd you say despite her beautiful hair, she was shy? People with because beautiful red hair can be shy.
Red hair is like, you know, people think like fiery, you know? People think like, oh, she's so out there with her red hair.
I don't really know anyone who thinks that way.
Do you know anyone who has red hair?
Yeah.
Naturally?
And I don't assume, yes. Like a natural redhead, yeah.
Who?
Madeline. Her name's Madeline. It doesn't matter what her name is. But I'm just saying, like, I don't assume you're going to be this, like, fiery person. That's, like, a weird stereotype. What's the stereotype for brunettes?
But it's not. Like, it's, like, not weird because it's a stereotype. So, therefore, it's normal.
Okay, whatever. That was a weird sentence to say. And for any of our red-haired listeners, just be yourself. Don't worry. Whatever Marva thinks about you.
You know what? I probably copy and pasted this sentence from somewhere else. So,
Marva. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Hanny's dream as a child was to become a teacher, but possibly because she was so shy, she decided against it because she felt overwhelmed by the idea of having to keep a classroom under control. She decided instead to study law at the University of Amsterdam because she wanted to be a human rights lawyer and go to Geneva to join the League of Nations.
Wow. Ambitious girl.
Yeah. Do you know what the League of Nations is?
It was something that was developed after World War One. Kind of like a precursor to the UN.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah. Freshman year history just came in clutch. Oh my gosh.
Yes, it was meant to be a way of preventing further wars, like after the Great War. And it also looked at like other things like labor conditions, the treatment of native inhabitants of like colonized places, human and drug trafficking, arms trade, global health, prisoners of war, and protection of minorities in Europe. But I guess considering we're talking about this in an episode about World War II, I think that it was pretty unsuccessful.
Also, I'm like, colonization, like, or people in colonies, and like, you guys still were owning all these countries. Like, what are you talking about? Like, you weren't like, oh no, like, people have rights. You were like, we're gonna keep exploiting you until like you fight us forever. Like,
Yeah, but it's like, oh, like the British are gonna be like, listen, at least we don't treat you as bad as the Germans because, listen, you're lucky to have us, actually.
Oh
And the Germans are
gosh.
like to the same thing about like those Brits, man.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that happened in the League of Nations. Like, I'm pretty sure that conversation, word for word, happened. Hani, however, would go on to do incredible things without the League of Nations. Unfortunately, Hani didn't have the opportunity to finish her law degree because, as we said, in 1940, the Germans invaded and she would have to find her own way of fighting for justice. So she ended up dropping out of university because the university tried to force all students to sign a pledge of loyalty to Germany, and Hani was like, not about it.
That's so crazy.
Yeah. So instead, she would steal ID cards for Jewish friends and residents of her city to help them get new identities and escape persecution. And it was through this work that she then joined the Council of Resistance. Hani, though, did not want to just act as a courier for the resistance. Like, as we said, that's like a more typical female role. She wanted to fight and work with weapons. And so, like Truce and Freddie, Hani worked to sabotage bridges and railroads and used dynamite to blow them up.
Dang.
So, we've now gotten to the point where Truce and Freddie and Hani are all working together in the resistance movement. And so, after working for a while, the girls stepped up their resistance work to put them in a league of their own. Hani, Truce, and Freddie used their youth and good looks to their advantage to seduce, trap, and kill Nazi and Dutch collaborators.
Wow, good job, girls.
Yes, I mean, it's a bit odd because they are literally teenagers,
Teenagers. I
but.
know, but it's like I have respect because these guys are creepy and like on top of being Nazis, like they're
Yeah.
creepy because they're like trying to flirt with a 16 or 14-year-old. So it's like, joke's on you. I'm gonna kill you. Like, that's really
Yeah.
cruel. It's like using feminine power in a good way.
Yeah. So, a quote from the book Seducing and Killing Nazis by Sophie Poldermans. She says, "So what is it that this clever, auburn-haired Hani, the down-to-earth tomboy and natural leader Truce, and the feminine and fierce Freddie had in common? They honored the same ideal of a livable world and felt compelled by the inhuman conditions of the German occupation to take up arms against the enemy in order to fight injustice." Okay, so in 1943, Hani is like 22, 23, Truce is 19, Freddie is 15, and they're at this point veteran resistors. The Oversteegen family has been helping Jews escape Germany since the mid-1930s, and Hani's been doing whatever she can to help people escape and assisting in the resistance in whatever way possible. When the three girls meet through the resistance, what results is a powerful friendship. Hani and Truce and Freddie are basically able to hide in plain sight. They ride around the city on their bikes. They flirt with German officers and Dutch collaborators. In the early days, the girls would mainly go out and seduce Nazis, bring them to a location where somebody else from the resistance would be waiting to kill them.
Wow, oh my gosh, this is crazy.
So, an example is once Truce went to a restaurant, flirted with a high-ranking SS officer while Freddie was outside standing as lookout. Truce then asked the officer to go for a walk with her in the woods, and while they were on their walk, they bumped into a man who was actually a resistance member who then executed the Nazi officer and put him in a hole they had dug earlier.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay. Dang. Don't go in the woods on, like with strangers, even the strangers like a teenage girl. Trust no one.
Yeah, I feel like this is like a very much like, as a woman, you would never go into the woods with a stranger
I know.
anyways.
Yeah,
But
it's
I
your own
guess
fault,
these Nazi
okay?
guys.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm so impressed. This is so interesting. I can't believe I didn't know about this. Where was this in my freshman history class? Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, we'll get to that a bit later. So, as time went on, though, the girls started to take on solo missions as well. Their work moved just from being Nazi officers to also being collaborators who endangered Jewish refugees or resistance members. And sometimes they would track and eliminate targets by following them home. Or they would ride a bike and one of them would pedal while the other one stood on the back of the bicycle firing shots.
Wow.
It's
That's
wild.
dangerous as well. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's just like I'm trying to like imagine like a 15-year-old on the
On a
back of like
bike.
not a motorcycle, just like a
I
little bicycle
Yeah.
with a
But there's
gun, just like
advantages to that.
bang.
Like, it's quiet. Like, you wouldn't hear someone riding a bike behind you.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you wouldn't pay attention if, like, a little girl was, like, walking behind you for a while, you know? Like, versus if it's, like, a man in a motorcycle, like, driving up behind, you're gonna be like, oh, like, I'm suspicious. Like, you know?
Yeah, so their flirt to kill methods, however, are what the girls would become most known for. Typically inviting, like what I said before, like inviting Nazis into the forest on the outskirts of the city for a romantic rendezvous where either one of the girls would be waiting for them in the forest to assassinate the Nazi, or they would have a gun like in their basket of their bicycle and then assassinate, eliminate is what they said, eliminate the target in the forest and then just ride on their bicycle and leave.
Oh my gosh. I can't believe no one caught on to this.
Yeah, Freddie being, I mean, Freddie was like literally 15, and my next sentence is Freddie being so young at the time, she was especially good at like tracking targets because she was so unsuspecting looking like on her bicycle. She would also like wear her hair in like little braids and
Oh my
like just
gosh.
make herself look even younger.
I want to look at pictures. I wonder, did you find any pictures of them?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to see.
Don't look up
Don't have.
anything now.
Why?
'Cause I don't want you to get any more spoilers.
I'm just looking at Freddie Overseen Teenager.
Okay.
Go ahead, continue.
Okay. Hanny, Truce, and Freddie were all completely driven by their passion for justice and for helping people. This even at times extended to the targets they were meant to be eliminating. Freddie said sometimes she would shoot a man and then feel a strange compulsion to try and help him up. The tragedies they saw around them every day, though, is what made it impossible for them not to act. Truce described how one day she was riding her bike when she saw Nazis picking up innocent people from the streets, putting them against a wall, and shooting them.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, when you're fighting such a huge evil, like, it's obviously like you're the lesser of two evils, but it's still like so traumatizing at such a young age to be doing that. And that would make like such a complicated relationship within your mind with your like your romantic life or like your sexuality, like growing up. Like, you view yourself as like a threat, I feel like. I don't know. That would be like really confusing.
Yeah. I just like I've never killed anybody and I can't actually imagine what it's like to kill someone.
And to kill like multiple people.
Yeah, and I feel like you would be kind of like, oh, like if you saw someone like on the street like bleeding, you'd want to help them, but then you're like, oh, actually it was me, like I did that to
Yeah.
you.
But I mean, also think about the fact that like in war, like the boys who go to war, like they're like barely 18, like they're also really young and they're going out, like some of these soldiers, like maybe not the ones they're killing because they were like higher ranking people, but like they're also just like kids, you know, who just like one day like picked up a gun and now they're committing like mass murder. So like this isn't like unusual. It's just unusual to see like a girl doing this, I feel like.
Yeah, but I feel like also it's because they're not like, I mean, obviously the Netherlands is at war, but they aren't like on the front lines. Like they're in their town where then they go home to their
Yeah, that's
bed
true.
and their parents
Yeah.
and like
Yeah, just living a normal life, like a double life, kind of. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so I have a quote next, again, from Seducing and Killing Nazis. It says, "You can only have any political conviction or be totally against war, but at that moment, you are just a human being confronted with something very cruel. Shooting innocent people is murder. If you experience something like this, you'll find it justified to act against it." This is from Truth, who she told her friend Sophie Poldermans, who wrote the book Seducing and Killing Nazis. She then goes on to say, "Once I was confronted with an SS soldier, a Dutch SS soldier even, who was killing a small baby by hitting it against a wall."
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he grabbed the baby and hit it against the wall. The father and sister had to watch. They were obviously hysterical. The child was dead. I shot that guy, right then and there. That wasn't even an assignment, but I don't regret it.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's so horrible. That's so crazy.
Yeah, so like they are seeing like true evil like in their presence in their hometown. Like it would just be such a weird and confusing thing to try and like put together. Being driven by their moral convictions, though, also led them not to follow every order they received. Hanny was once asked to kidnap the children of a Nazi official, but she refused. She knew that if whatever the plan was failed, the children would be killed. That was not something she could support or live with. She felt that this was too similar to what the Nazis, who they were fighting, would do.
That's good. I feel like that's like the benefit of it being like kind of like a day job, you know, like you're, this isn't like your whole life. You can't get, you like, you don't get brainwashed as easily. I feel like if you're like in war and everyone around you is doing this, like, and then like, because like what human being can get to a point where they think it's like okay to smash a baby? Like most of us, like that's like physically impossible, like but like you're like in it, and then you just like start to think like this is like justifiable and like you know, like even good or something. And like, but if you're just going quote unquote to work and like doing it and then going home and like sopping, like it's easier to have like draw lines of like where your morals are, you know?
Yeah That makes sense. So throughout the length of the war, the girls kept up their resistance work, working together and independently. Despite their circumstances, all three formed a very close bond. We don't know how many assassinations or liquidations, as the girls called it, they completed. When asked about it, Freddie said that they were soldiers, and soldiers never admit how many people they've killed. Even without the exact numbers, though, we know that they were making an impact and instilling fear in the Nazis. There were whispers around town about the girl with the red hair. Even though they didn't know who she was, Hanny was someone well known to be feared. In 1944, a friend, or maybe a lover, don't know, of Hanny's, Jan Bonekamp, and Hanny carried out an assassination of a Dutch collaborator and police officer. Hanny shot the officer in the back, but he then returned fire and shot Jan in the stomach before finally being killed. No. Jan tried to flee, but had to be taken to the hospital for his injuries, and on his deathbed, he revealed Hanny's identity and her address.
Oh my gosh!
This was either by accident, where he told a Dutch nurse who he did not realize was, like, a Nazi, or he was tortured. Like, he didn't, like, give it up just by, like, oh, yeah, you know, my last dying wish is that you find my friend and kill her.
Yeah, no, I would not be trusting anyone in this scenario.
I don't know, but a nurse, people trust nurses. Either way, the identity of the girl with the red hair was now known, and this was not good for Hanny. In an effort to get Hanny to confess her crimes, the Nazis sent her parents to the Herzogenbosch concentration camp in Vught, which is in the Netherlands. This was enough to get Hanny to temporarily pause her resistance work, but she did not give in. Her parents were released after 2 months, and later that year, in September of 1944, the camp was liberated by the Allies, although most of the 31,000 people who were being held there were transferred to other camps.
Oh no, oh my gosh.
When the mostly Scottish and Canadian forces arrived, there were 500 people left alive at the camp, and they were due to be executed that afternoon. Another 500 were found dead near the gates of the camp, and they had been executed that morning.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
That's so sad. Like, literally, you're like a few hours away from liberation. Yeah.
It is so sad, but it is, like, for Hanny's parents, just, like, insanely lucky that they got out before they got transferred to another camp.
Yeah, true.
But if you want to know more about the Herzogenbusch camp, concentration camp, there are two diaries of prisoners, the diary of David Coker and the diary of Helga Dean, that can be read. Both Helga and David did not survive the war, but their diaries survived to tell their stories. So, after Hanny's close call with the Nazis, she dyed her famous red hair black to avoid detection. The three girls continued their resistance work for the rest of 1944 and into the beginning of 1945. In April 1945, Freddie and Truce became concerned when they hadn't heard from their dear friend Hanny in a little while. She was due to report back after an assignment transporting secret documents. On the 21st of March, Hanny had been arrested at a military checkpoint. She was interrogated, tortured, and put in solitary confinement. Hanny, though, would never betray her cause and her friends. In the end, it was a former friend of hers and the roots of her red hair that would give her away.
Oh, no.
A former colleague, Anna.
And, like, they saw? Oh, yeah, my gosh, they saw that's her so red roots.
Yeah. A former colleague, Anna Winhoff, recognized her hair as the dye started to grow out and identified her as the famous girl with the red hair that they'd been searching for.
Oh, my gosh.
On April 17th, 1945, Hanny was executed. Two men shot her at close range, only injuring her, though, and she's said to have her last words have been, "Ich schieß better," or "I'm a better shot." She was then shot and killed by a third bullet.
Wow. Oh my gosh, that gave me chills. That's so crazy.
Yes. This, tragically, though, was just 3 weeks before the end of the war.
Oh my gosh. I hate stories like this.
Yeah. Freddie and Truce did survive the war, but their experiences and the loss of their best friend was almost more than they could deal with. They tried to begin living a normal, quiet life, but really, they had never lived one before, and the trauma of their experiences left them with symptoms of what we would now recognize as PTSD.
I'm sure.
Freddie eventually got married and had a family, while Truce threw herself into artwork. She sculpted multiple memorials to their dear friend Hanny. For themselves, but more particularly for the memory of their friend, the sisters fought for years to have their work as part of the Dutch resistance officially recognized. Since they were communists and worked with communists, and they were women, their work kind of got overlooked.
I see.
The war.
That's a bias about people.
Yeah.
Why people don't talk about them.
Yeah. So in 1996, Freddie and Truce opened the National Hanny Schaft Foundation, which every year honors the sacrifices of Dutch women and men who fought in the resistance. A regular and much appreciated part of the commemoration is the Hanny Schaft Lecture. At the invitation of the foundation, a prominent Dutch person tells how Hanny Schaft's story is relevant to our time in his or her view.
That's cool.
Yeah. It wasn't until 2014 that the Dutch Prime Minister gave Freddie and Truce the recognition they deserved for their hard work and sacrifices. They were awarded the Mobilization War Cross. Truce died at the age of 92 in 2016, and Freddie died 2 years later, one day before her 93rd birthday, in September of 2018.
Wow, they lived a long time.
Yeah. Before their passing, Truce wrote a memoir titled Not Then, Not Now, Not Ever, and they made friends with Sophie Poldermans, who wrote about all three women in Seducing and Killing Nazis, Hanny, Truce, and Freddie, Dutch resistance heroines of World War II. It's a very long title for a book.
But a good title.
Yeah. Sophie wrote, I have no romantic image of their work. They were no cowgirls. They inspired me on many levels, but their work in pursuit of the right thing was, by necessity, ruthless. So, after 20 years of friendship, Sophie knew the trauma and loss they experienced stayed with them for the rest of their lives. So, hopefully, we can all keep up the legacy of Hanny and Freddie and Truce and work to ensure that anti-Semitism and discrimination have no place in our world. Not then, not now, not ever. And that's the end. That's the story of Hanny, Truce, and Freddie.
Wow. Thank you, Marva. That was, of course, really heartbreaking at parts, but I think probably like the most interesting story I've heard on our podcast. Like, it's just like such an interesting concept of, like, you know, I said, like, the whole, like, feminine power thing, like, using, like, what people perceive on the outside as a weakness, as your strength. I, like, really love that kind of thing. And, like, just, like, they got away, like, we don't know how many people they were able to eliminate, but, like, they got away with it for, like, a long time, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And were, like, working from the very beginning, like, even independently, before the resistance, like, caught them, like, caught their eye or whatever. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really impressive.
I feel like we always like to, you know, make sure that we tell full human stories. And I feel like there is, like, that part of me, like, I definitely chose this because I was like, that's so cool, seducing and killing Nazis, like, amazing. But then reading more about them and remembering, oh, they're human teenagers, really.
Yeah.
And, like, although from this outside perspective, I'm like, yes, girl power, kill those Nazis. They had to, like, live with the killing of people, you know, for their lives.
The rest of their lives, yeah.
Yeah.
For their entire adult lives, yeah.
Yeah. And so the loss of their friend, like, they, I'm assuming they would have, they said that she was, like, their best friend, and obviously they did all of this stuff for her memory, but I would imagine have just, like, had, like, such a deeper bond than even, like, what we think of, like, best friends, you know.
Yeah, and probably so much guilt that, like, she was the one who got caught, like, because it could have been you, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, she didn't betray them until the very end.
Like, no, she didn't betray them at all.
No, I'm saying, like, not, like, up, like, all the way until the end. Like, she never betrayed them. Yeah.
Yeah. But just the, to the very end sounded very sarcastic.
Sorry. No. I meant, like, all the way until the end of her life. Yeah. Yeah, so amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Well, yeah, thanks for that episode. Okay, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I know I definitely did. I learned a lot and learned about the importance of telling stories of, like, unexpected heroes, even if we disagree with, like, communism or whatever, like, that the American school system disagrees with. And we don't learn about these kind of things. It's still really important to tell these stories, and especially to lift up, like, women's roles in, like, unexpected places. So keep telling these stories and learning stuff.
keep talking to us.
Yeah. We are the source.
we'll continue to tell these stories. Thank you. You do nothing. You just listen.
Yes.
Cool. So shall we sign off?
We shall.
Okay. Ready? One, two. This is Sistery.